Frank Felt. Tape number 2, side A.
Yes, I'd like to tell you about my acquaintance with Emil Massey, which took place back in the 30s, early 30s. He lived on the east side in our neighborhood, and he belonged to the Young Proletarian Party called the Yipsels. And we used to have another name for him. Literally translated was piss pots.
it was a little bit of a deal.
But anyways, Emil used to make speeches on Lodge Park, which is where the Spurl School is, where we had our hall there in the back, I told you, on Centerline Avenue. And he used to make speeches for the Young Proletarian Party, and Zygmunt Borowski, an organizer in the YCL, used to make speeches for the YCL, and they were side by each. And we, the one with the loudest voice usually gathered most of them close by, you know. But anyhow, in 1937, the State Emergency Relief Administration gave out funds for educational purposes, and they established a school at the northeastern branch of the YMCA on Gratiot and Harper, or Cadillac and Harper, actually, the right location. And these classes that they set up there were, one was in public speaking, one was in Spanish and psychology, and I believe that was the extent at that time of the courses. So Emil Massey joined this school, Zygmunt, myself, and there was quite a number of Ziggy's brother, Teddy. All these brothers, his brothers, my brothers, and Emil. And we had a professor from the U of M teaching public speaking, Professor Skinner by name. Incidentally, I never forget his name. And part of his class was to, especially I remember this one time, was to, he says, when you come to class, whatever you happen to observe or see, I'd like you to make a speech on that. So, lo and behold, when it got out of the class time, well, this one fella gets up and not only that, but or of an experience you've had, yeah. And this fella started giving his experience. He evidently was from middle class parents. And he was giving a speech about fishing on the Indian River, and here people, you know, are still hungry, you know, and he's talking about fishing on the Indian River, and the smell of bacon and eggs, you know, coming down, floating down the river. And so the Professor Skinner, he says, well, that was a very nice speech, you know, and then called on me, and I said, well, I'd like to talk about the young newsboy that was standing on the corner of Gratiot and Harper hawking his papers. And looking at him, he looked like he could stand a good meal and could stand clothes and so on and so forth. Anyways, in essence, I spoke of the economic situation. After I got through making my little speech, Professor Skinner said to me, he says, Frank, he says, I believe you'd be the type of a person that would go in an art museum and see if you could find fly specks on a Mona Lisa painting.
You remember that comment?
Yeah.
And, boy.
And the rest of them got up. Emil got up and made a speech, which was economic and political, as well as Zygmunt and the rest of us. But also, while attending those classes, they had a youth meeting in Ann Arbor. They had, what was it called now? It was youth throughout the country. I'm trying to think of the... Anyways, they wanted delegates from various groups and so on and so forth. So myself and Tony Nowakowski got ourselves to be delegates from the Northeastern branch of the YMCA. We went there as delegates, although we weren't really representing the Y because we didn't belong to the Y, but we belonged to the school. But we went there as members of the YMCA, or delegates. And the director of the YMCA, he come down to this, to Ann Arbor, to this meeting. And I can't recall the, what was he? Well, anyhow, it was divided into various symposiums and groups, and one group discussed economics, another politics, another so on and so forth. And the director of the Y, he come and sat in our group where we were sitting, and he listened to us express our opinions and so on and so forth. And he called us to the side afterwards. He says, it's very fine, he says, but I think to represent the YMCA, you should be members of the YMCA. So, anyhow, that was a 3-day meeting in Ann Arbor. It was a nationwide meeting of youth. Again, if I can't remember the title of the meeting, but it should
year?
Be.
The year? Have you got the year?
I believe that was in 1937. 36 or 37. In fact, I was elected onto the continuations committee, but I never did function on it, you know.
This is about the time that the YCL nationally is becoming, or the youth movement nationally is becoming,
is
peaking.
They had, movements against war and fascism, and so on and so forth. We had a Chicago meeting at that. I don't know. I'm trying to recall what year that was, but we went there. We hitchhiked, and in fact, we rode the freight to Chicago to go to that meeting.
I wanted to get to Dennis's question about the factional disputes within the labor movement, but maybe we can get back to this other one later.
Well, I wanted to finish this. I got kind of rambled off on this other deal, but I wanted to finish this about Emil Mazianus. Mm. So there was a vice president, I believe, or someone on the board of directors of the Rotary Electric Steel Company on 8 Mile and Mound Road that was staying at the YMCA, at that branch of the YMCA, and he had told the manager, or whatever you might call the head of the Y there, that if there's some deserving young fellows that want a job, well, we could get a job over the Rotary Electric Steel Company, you know. So we went down there and we got a job. Emil got a job there, I got a job there, Zygmunt didn't get a job. His brother did, and Tony and my oldest brother, Toivo. We all got jobs there. And we were working in the cold draw. That was after the steel went through the hot mill and it went through the pickling tanks and then come into the cold draw where they draw the bar. They made bar steel and they straightened. They drew the steel and straightened and made hex and round steel and so on and so forth. And then we'd work midnights, afternoons, and days. I mean, it was a split deal, something like every third day you were on a different shift. Anyways, or was it every week? Maybe we changed every week. Yeah, I believe it was. I think we changed every week. But so it was hard work, and we started, well, Emil, he started talking union, and we all started talking union. Pretty soon we were all out because there was no union in there.
Oh.
So we were fired out of there. And that's when Emil went from there. Emil went to Briggs. He went to work at Briggs. He got a job at Briggs, and he carried on his union activities there. And I believe, let's see, that was, what the hell year was that? 36 or 37. That had to be.
We can look that one up from Emil Mazie's history.
It had to be 36, yet, because we didn't, that was the beginning of the CIO drive, you know, for the Congress of Industrial Organization. Yeah, it had to be 36, right? And I tried to get back from Dodge's. I never did get back in. You know, I worked the 34 program, and then 35 program, I didn't get called back in. So this one Finn told me, he said, well, you meet Brown. He was the superintendent. He said, you meet him, and when he comes out at night, and you ask him, you know. And he's a pretty good Joe. So I did, you know, and Brown said, okay, he says, meet me tomorrow night and I'll let you know, you know. So the next night I met him, and here comes Mr. Brown, comes out of the plant, and I says, Mr. Brown, you told me to meet you. He said, look, I don't have nothing to do with you. Kept on going, you know. And that kind of tipped me off then, and I said, uh-oh, you know.
You had the stamp.
Yeah, I had the stamp. Well, this gurney, you know, working for the railway audit, you know, had already fingered me in. And so I didn't get back. And when I did go back, I went back to work there in 37 and got into the sit-down strike. But I went to work under a assumed name, Frank Schultz, S-H-U-L-T-Z. So I was Frank Schultz during the sit-down strike. And I could have changed my name to back to my real name after the sit-down, but I quit Dodge's because I the work I was doing there wasn't appealing to me, so I wanted to get into something, and that's how I got into 2-1-Die.
Where were you when the sit-down took place, or how did it come about, your recollection?
Well, the sit-down strike took place. I was working days, and I was working in, I was hired in there, and I was working in what they call the old man's department at that time. The old men were working there, were just assembling clutches, and I worked in that department, and the sit-down strike took place, so I stayed in the plant. And I had a very good friend of mine, Carl Deutsch, who was also an activist politically, you know, he belonged to the YCL.
Yeah. Your wife mentioned him.
Yeah, Carl Deutsch, yeah. Mm-hmm. And and Carl says, well, Frank, he says, well, you're in here. He says, you might as well take an active part in it. He says, I'll talk to the strike committee. He was on the strike committee. He says, and recommend for you to be the captain of the main gate, you know. In other words, have charge of the main gate, the only entrance into the plant during the sit-down. Supposedly the only entrance of the people that had gone over the fence and so on and so forth. But that was the only gate that was legally open, you know, for access.
Now that's when you met Angela.
She might have seen me, but she didn't know me then, you know, because that.
Right.
She just come to, she was working afternoons, and she come to go to work, and she never seen her on strike, and she threw her lunch over the fence and took off.
Oh.
She remembered
that you had been the gateman at the strike.
No, she knows it because I told her.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay, that was later on.
You know,
all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's where she recollects that. Okay. No, I didn't meet her until 1939.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So
you don't hear much about the activities in the Dodge sit-down. You hear a lot about Flint.
Mm-hmm.
How was it organized and inside,
well,
and what did
right.
workers do, and
okay.
this sort of thing?
All right, yeah. Well, first of all, we had the strike committee in the plant, which was the main Corps, you know, the basic
Who was that strike committee, do you remember?
The chairman of the strike committee at that time, Frank Reed was the chairman.
Green?
Reed, R-E-I-D.
Frank Reed.
Frank Reed. He also later on became the president of Dodge Local. He was the president of Dodge Local for one term, I believe. And Tony Proby, Tony Proby. The Proby boys were real active.
Is that Jake's brother?
Yeah, Jake Proby's brother, Tony, oldest brother. He's a plumber now.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's retired now. And his other brother wasn't in the plant, but he also was working at Dodge's at that time. The one that became a lawyer died. He died. Tony, Jake, and on the tip of my tongue, I can't think of it. But regardless, he was also in a Dodge Local at that time. But Tony was a real active member of Dodge Local at that time, and he was a politically conscious person. From his brother was a. One of his brothers, another brother, is a member of Parliament in Canada, an MP from his district in Canada.
Hmm.
And when Tony was active, he was anti-Ruther. And I guess they tried to give him, or Frankenstein tried to give him the business that he was in this country illegally and so on and so forth. But nothing come about it, but it done a lot of damage to Tony's career in the labor movement, so to speak. But the strike committee, and then the strike committee set up had a person responsible to set up, and that was Pat Quinn, who later became a president of Dodge Local 3, set up a so-called police department within the plant, you know, to police the plant. And then his assistant, I can't recall the guy's name, but anyways, he was another sit-downer. And myself, I automatically become a member of that committee. And we went to all the departments and broke into the files to uncover who was the stooges and so on and so forth. We uncovered quite a few of them. And we also uncovered when we got into, I think it was 76th Department, the guy that was the assistant police chief was also a stooge.
Jeez.
So what happened there was that we called up the Plymouth Local and had the flying squadron of the Plymouth Local come down to Dodge, to Dodge's, escort this guy out of the plant, and that's the last I ever heard of that guy. I don't know whatever happened to him. But anyways, he was the flying squadron of Plymouth escorted him out. We set up a kitchen. We used the facilities, the kitchen in the Dodge plant. Had our own cooks, cooked the food, served food, hot food to the sit-downers. Others had in their departments made all types of stoves and stuff and barbecues and whatnot, you know. Using acetylene. We patrolled, we kept the plant clean. We made sure that no liquor was brought in, you know, as much as possible, you know. That was one of my main functions on the main gate, to shake them down as they come in to make sure that they weren't bringing it in, and we'd confiscate and destroy it, really. And see that there was no hanky-panky going on in the plant, mm-hmm. You know. There were no women sitting down in the plant, but, you know, how young guys are. Well, some of them might have figured, well, they'd bring their girlfriend in or something, mm-hmm. You know, so on and so forth. They sat down there for 89 days, so I guess some of them got desperate. But we had a little fire in one of the tunnels, some guy tried to sabotage it, you know, and got some oily rags and lit them to make it seem as though there was a great big fire going on. But the night before that, the strike committee had made a decision not to let anyone with arms into the plant, that meant police or anyone else, see? And so the following night when they had the fire, well, the fire department come down, and then this policeman was following the fire department, and he wanted to go right into the plant with them. I says, well, I stopped him and I told him, I said, well, look, you can go into the plant, but you'll have to leave your firearms in the office here, and then when you come back out, we'll give them to you. He says he couldn't do that, he'd be out of uniform. So I told him, well, I said, well, if you're going to be out of uniform, I won't want you to be that way, so you might just as well go out. So
goodbye.
So he went out.
And he did.
The following night, well, we found out that it was actually a sabotage deal. You know, the fire, they wanted to create a panic and the whole thing to clean the plant out. In reality, that was a devious motive behind the whole thing. The following night, the Hamtramck Commissioner of Police come down there, and he says he wanted to see Frank Reed, and I says, well, okay, you want to come in? He says, no, he says, he'll stay outside. So I call up Frank Reed and tell him that the police commissioner would like to see him, so Frank come down and walked out down Joseph Campo with the police commissioner. I guess they had a talk, and on the way back, Frank come back, and he says to me, he says, hey, Schultz, he says, let's relax on that rule, you know, about firearms. We should leave the policeman in. That's what I was discussing with the commissioner. And I says, look, I'm doing what the strike committee says. Now, if you want to relax that, you'll have to bring that up before the strike committee and relax it. Well, he never did, so there was nothing else to come about that. But they never did. We wanted to go into the. At least it was my position to go into the safe in the employment office where all our records were kept. Because the company knew that we were going through these records, and that's why they were anxious actually to get us out of the plant. Really, in one sense, because we were breaking down a big program that they had set up for years. You know, their spying program and so on and so forth. And actually, they knew that we wouldn't hesitate to go into the files. But Pat Quinn says, nah, we won't go into that. So I guess I was overrode on that deal. But I would like to have gone into the main vault, you know, where they had the main records. Nothing was said about this after the strike. The company never raised a murmur about us going into their files. And all the files were broken into. I mean, the locks were either cut off or they were burned off. If we couldn't cut them off, we burned them off with an acetylene torch. And
they never said anything about
that? No, nothing was said.
Was that pretty much the minimum amount of destruction that was done?
There was actually, as far as destruction is concerned, there was no destruction in the plant at all. In fact, we had it set up so that each department was responsible for the conditions in their department and keep them intact, that they wouldn't destroy anything, or if anyone was caught destroying anything, immediately he should be brought before the strike committee and we'd take care of him, you know. And the only time that there was any big movement of anything was when the threat of the National Guard to come in and oust us. And that's when we moved all took the high lows and moved all kinds of scrap and stuff in the boxes up under the roof, mm-hmm. in preparation, you know, for the invasion, so to speak. And we had it up well arranged, you know, that these and the high lows would stay up there with the forklift trucks, you know, and with these on, and that they could just tip them over the side when it was necessary, you know. In other words, we were prepared to fight if they were going to evict us without settling the strike. And that's when John L. Lewis come into Michigan and talked to Murphy. Murphy was the governor then, and they, in their talk, they settled the thing about the National Guard, so the National Guard wasn't called out, and then the company got into serious negotiation with Lewis, and shortly thereafter the strike was settled, you know, the system, and we left the plants after 89 days.
I have one more question, then I'm going to let Betty get into her subject, because I think we're running out of time, and I hope that I can come back at some other time and maybe talk to you about some more of the labor history. But how would you characterize the leadership of the strike committee politically? Was it dominated by one political faction or another?
No.
And was there much disunity in the strike committee over tactics or over issues that could be politically identified? You know, a lot of discussion goes on about the Flint sit-down strikes, whether the socialists or the communists or the proletarian party did this and did that. I wondered if that sort of factionalism within the strike committee at Dodge existed, to your knowledge.
No. There was petty differences, and I imagine, like Frank Reed was ambitious. And he did become the president of the local. Mm-hmm. It was petty politics being played, but the only one that actually would have that they would have picked on would have been Carl Deutsch, because he was known as a communist, you know, and they didn't, you know. And Deutsch gave a lots of good, basic, sound leadership to the strike committee. He wasn't actually a member of the strike committee as such, but he was so close to him, and they looked towards him, to him, for leadership, because he was able to provide him with leadership due to his, I would say his background, and his being active amongst people.
Is Mr. Deutsch still living?
He's out on the West Coast somewhere. I don't know if he's still living or not. He'd be a couple of years older than me. He was, we used to kid him, he was perpetually going to school. In fact, he was a Wayne State alumnus, I believe. I believe he graduated. I'm not sure if he graduated from Wayne State, but he attended numbers of classes here at Wayne State.
Betty, I'm going to terminate my part and let you take your...
I have the feeling that there's a big gap. In fact, I'm drawing a line across my page that might be filled in with the experiences you had in other areas that I don't know as much about as Dennis, but let's just assume that sometime you can fill in that gap.
Yeah.
And I do want to get to the Finn camp. I've been getting already some conflicting versions of how the camp was organized and so on. You want to stop, Dennis, or?
No.
Okay. Okay, when did you get involved in the organization of the Finn Camp? Were you a member of the DFEA?
My mother and father were members.
Your
of
parents,
the
through your parents.
Yeah,
that's
parents.
Right. Okay, so the story of your involvement with the Finn Camp begins with your parents.
Right.
They were members of the DFEA, as were they identified as Finnish.
Right.
Would
right.
it be fair to say that they identified as Finnish more than you did? You identified as union or a worker or. Your people met down in that hall.
Yeah,
their people
right.
met with other Finns.
Right.
That's
yeah,
the same
were,
in my family.
Yeah, they were basically Finnish.
So the DFEA was
but
their
us,
organization.
Yeah, but us children were, due to where we live, we didn't, at that time, the Finnish people in our neighborhood kind of scattered out too, you know, and there weren't too many Finnish families remaining.
Yeah.
We were one of the few that were still remaining in that original neighborhood.
Yeah. In contrast to Woodrow Wilson, for instance,
yeah.
where you had.
See, Woodrow Wilson. Well, it seemed like the Finnish groups, those people like that lived on the east side where we lived, were people that were acquainted with my father, you know, in the old country. Or they were worked with him or lived in the same town and so on and so forth. And most of those people all got together and lived in the same vicinity. And that would same would hold true like on Woodrow Wilson, the people that come from the Upper Peninsula down here start living around Woodrow
that's
Wilson
right.
and
that's right.
and
that's
eventually
right.
all of them.
That's my grandfather. Yeah. I was born up in Hancock, and he came down and lived on 1508 Fullerton, right off Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah,
that's right,
right.
That's right. So the UP people live together and so on.
Right.
Okay, now, the DFEA, as I understand it, was the organization that from which the group emerged that started, that
really?
Had the idea. What can, where do, how was the idea of a Finn camp born, to start with? I mean, the DFEA is 1906. The Finn camp doesn't begin till 1925.
25, right. But the DFEA built the hall, 14th Street Hall. And
they're on the 14th Street Hall, and they had to sell that.
Yeah, well, they sold that. They had to sell it afterwards.
Now,
the hall was built in 19, I believe it was built in 19.
I don't want to get into the hall because we've already covered that.
Anyway,
it's the Finn camp itself.
Yeah, 25. Well, the DFEA, the people, 70% of the people in the DFEA also become members of the Detroit Finnish Summer Camp Association.
And Elmer has told that story. And how they looked for different sites, and as you said, they were first in another place and then moved to the Loon Lake. Now, I think I'll ask you straight out, I hope this doesn't tilt the answer, but it's Elmer's version that the feeling from the beginning was that the Finn camp was not supposed to be political, that everything political was DFEA associated.
Well, that's true, that's true.
But also that if it weren't for the DFEA, the Finn camp would never have survived economically.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And so then
that's a good basic statement.
Okay.
But it also, in the DF, the summer camp would not deny the DFEA members of their political doings.
Oh, and that's important to say.
See?
The summer camp would not tell them that you cannot...
That they could conduct their business and sell their literature and have their meetings or whatever, you know, if it was a play or so on and so forth that they wanted to put on that was political. The summer camp had nothing to...
Okay.
I mean...
And is that in the minutes somewhere? Do you think they made a point of that?
I believe it. It should have been in the bylaws and so on and so forth originally.
As I hear the story, if it weren't for the, you say that the 70% of the Finn camp members were DFEA.
Right, right.
Okay.
Right.
So if it weren't for the DFEA, there wouldn't be a Finn camp.
That's correct.
And during the 30s, the DFEA bailed them out.
Right.
36, and they start selling beer, and they paid off their mortgage, and all of that story.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Now, what I want to know is when do you remember being involved at the Finn camp?
1925, right at the.
So you were there from the beginning.
Oh yeah.
Okay, you went swimming.
In fact, Henriksen's and Hevonkoski's and ourselves, us kids in our family, we spent the first summer out there in 1925 in Henriksen's tent. They had a great big army tent, and we stayed in their tent. And in fact, and there was a couple other families, I can't recall their name now, that stayed that first summer, you know.
The Holmans?
That's when it was all, it was nothing but practically a swamp, you know.
Okay, now that's, just before you came, I was putting on record my collection of those impressions, that that was quite a summer, and those first years were really something, and it involved working hard.
Yeah.
It also must have involved a vision. And from what Carl was saying, that included an educational program and a recreational program.
Right, right.
And I gather Carl has little respect for what we're doing today as compared to what they used to do in the old days in the way of calisthenics
true.
And so on. Well, you tell it in your own
and,
way.
Like I was talking to my mother yesterday, and she says she can recall that first summer out there, and the first time they were out there, they had to make coffee, and they made it over a fire, you know, an open fire with a pot, you know, and so they could brew their coffee, so they could have their coffee. And that first year they set up a platform up just about where the Rubbingtala is now, just in that region, because that's the high ground. The rest of it was swamp. Where the athletic field was, that was,
it was all
more or less swampy. Yeah, that was swamp. That was all filled in. And they set up a platform so they could have their dances, their Saturday night dances. And that's where they danced on this particular platform. And they also built, that first year, they built a sauna near the lake, about in the vicinity where the sauna is now. But to get to the lake, you had to lay boards down because it was all swamp and you had to walk on these boards, And there was no dock out there or anything,
There wasn't any, could you go from the sauna into the water?
No, you couldn't, you'd have to walk along these boards along the swamp. Not many people
were inclined to
do that, but all of us were, all the young people at that time, and lots of the we would consider older people then, which I would consider young people now, but those in their 30s and so on and so forth, married people,
And the spirit over there at the time you were organizing, a lot of enthusiasm, esprit de corps?
Right, collective, there was a collective spirit of building and constructing and making this a good place to live in or enjoy, and our children and their
children. Where did the vision for that come from? Did you have your meeting somewhere to talk about it?
Well, evidently, most of that come from discussions at the DFE, the educational club meetings. And they'd have regular meetings, and they had regular programs almost every weekend, at the Finn Hall. Mm-hmm. And before that, it was a House of Masses on Gratiot and St. Albans, which was actually a Schiller Hall, but they call it the House of Masses.
Okay, now the other half of the story, several halves of the story, when did you first begin to feel that there was an element opposing the leadership on the basis of politics?
Well, when they start looking on disfavor, this brother of mine, he had a paper out there, and he peddled a Daily Worker there, which was the Communist Party newspaper.
Yeah, I know. What year now? Are we in the 30s still?
Yeah, we're in the 30s. We're in the 30s. Well, that would be...
late 30s?
Let's see now. That would be in the 30, I'd say about 1935.
Okay, and by that time you got quite a few people out there. In fact, 1935 is the year they pay off the mortgage.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so he's got a lot of customers.
Yeah.
And the thing is beginning to roll.
Yeah.
It's a going concern.
Yeah.
And some kind of opposition emerges.
Yeah, right.
What did they do to him or tell him that he couldn't?
Well, no, they start harassing him and telling him that he shouldn't be selling these papers, and he'd done it anyways, regardless, that they weren't going to harass him. And this Venttinen, like I said, this Venttinen, he was one of the, his father, was one of the leaders in the opposition. And they eventually worked on it, and finally, for excuses to eliminate the whole thing, Oney drank a little, and once in a while, I guess, raised a little hell. But like all youth do, they do it the same thing now as they. In fact, they might even do it
good deal more.
Good deal more. Yeah. Right. But anyhow, it culminated in 1937. There was a Saturday night dance, and I was dancing in the hall, and someone come running in there, "Hey, they're beating up on your brother."
Oh yeah?
So I run out there and I seen this, and I pull the guys off, and I was pretty husky, and I was a pretty good boxer. I used to box,
and
I beat the hell out of the police department, what they call the police department out there that was working over Oney. And Oney got away then,
The official police, the official
the
police?
City.
No,
no, no, no, no. It wasn't part of Wixom then.
The camp had its own police to police
yeah,
the dances
right,
and so
right,
on,
right.
And only had gotten into some kind of fight
some
with them.
Some kind of squabble. I don't know what it was all about.
You went out to defend your brother, and you beat up the...
I heard they were beating him up.
That wasn't
so
designed to get you into good favor in the...
I suppose.
Okay, so after that, what happened?
Well, then we were arrested. They called the Pontiac Sheriff's Department, you know, the Oakland County Sheriff's Department in Pontiac, and they got on me, and then, and I didn't walk away, you know, because I felt I hadn't done anything wrong, you know, and I was sitting in the rubbing villa having coffee, and here comes the sheriffs, and they arrested me, you know. So then we were taken to the Oakland County Jail, and at that time I was working, well, that's a coincidence, too. I was working for Armisello's dad on a power hammer, you know. We were making some parts out on in East Detroit there. We were making some parts.
Why is it ironic?
Well, because...
Was Salo on the other side? I don't know.
No. His father wasn't active in the... No,
one way or the other.
No, he wasn't active in politics.
Okay. You said it was ironic because at the time you were working for him. I don't understand what was ironic.
Well, it was ironic to me to think of, you know, that that here was Sullo's dad I was working for, you know, and here I'm discussing this Lunlake business, you know. And it seems as though, well, it seemed funny to me, you know.
What did Sullo do?
Mr. Sullo, then I was working for him while...
What was his son doing? Was his son one
of
the police?
Well, his son, I guess, I guess his son just... I guess that's about the time he was, well, I don't know when he came out to Lunlake. I think he came out there in about 34, I guess, or somewhere in there. Well.
Is that the same Salo or Salo?
Yeah, Armis,
out there?
Yeah,
okay.
Carl, yeah.
Well, I don't know these people,
yeah.
You know, very well.
Yeah.
I guess I know the children and the children's
yeah.
children. And one of them said to me that as a child, he said, he or she said his dad remembered being given poetry to read at some of these things as a child, and then later was embarrassed to discover that he had read these poems, which were political in nature.
Oh, Armis said that?
I don't know. No. I don't even remember.
Oh.
See, I don't know these, which is which, and I have to be careful here, but I know that the name Salo, which is the name I've heard it, not Salo,
yeah.
But so I wondered if there was any connection between the political angle of this and your discovery of the irony. And
No, it's just... a thought that come into my mind.
Yeah,
you know?
Right, okay.
Because his father gave my mother the $25 to get me out on bond.
Oh, yeah?
Then we had a court case, and we got Oney out afterwards. And we had a court case, and we got a lawyer in Pontiac. And they threw the whole thing out of court because it was so ridiculous, you know. And this great big Venti then gets up there and testified how he slugged... one of the felts, he says, on the head with his flashlight. Our lawyer says, well, how big was the flashlight? He said, oh, about that big. He said, and I let him have it real good, you know. And it was my oldest brother, and he's a little short guy. He's only about 5'6½" or 7", you know. So you have him stand up, and
okay.
The judge
so
looks over,
time.
He says, well,
this
is terrible, you know.
Okay.
Anyways, so after... that was thrown out of court. Then the Ventinans, I would say Ventinans, started the move, you know, to have us ousted out of the camp, you know. The whole family.
Mm-hmm.
And they, legally, they couldn't have done that, you know, because they couldn't take my mother's and father's share away from them, because they had no reason to, because they hadn't done anything, eh? But anyways, they used that as an excuse, you know, and well, my mother got angry, and she says, the hell with the whole Southern and Finn camp, you know.
She gave up on the whole idea.
She says, you know, keep the goddamn thing, you know.
And sold her share.
Yeah, right, turned her share in, you know. Yeah.
Oh, that's so, she took the initiative.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so Angela had said, well, like, wouldn't let her sons visit her. So what's the point in having a cabin if your sons can't come out there and use the facilities?
Yeah, right. They was going to exclude us,
And let she,
yeah,
they couldn't exclude
she
her
said
legally.
Not a, she says she didn't want no part of that either, you know.
Okay. I see. Okay, now we got the story straight.
Yeah.
The thing that I find so ironic is that here you and your whole family were out there clearing the swamps and all the rest of it, and then they ended up ousting you.
Yeah.
But it
yeah.
was your mother's decision.
We helped.
Dennis, okay, it's 10 to 6.
Yeah.
Let's get one kind of summary statement in terms of...
If you think you're going to be here again or no?
I'm next year.
I mean, this weekend.
No.
This
no,
is it.
I came especially today
this
to meet with you.
Oh.
Yeah.
Gee, that's too bad.
Well, but you know, we've got next year, and we can build on this.
In the meanwhile, I probably can write down on paper.
Okay.
And if you leave me your address, I could even send it to you out in California.
What I will, yes.
See?
The general thing, too, and, you know, what you went
because
through during the McCarthy era, that's the thing. You know, it really got bad when you consider...
Yeah.
The enthusiasm that went into this. Okay, there were political differences and so on, but am I hearing the right story from people when I'm told that they went through all sorts of hell simply because they belonged to the Finn camp, and then the Finn camp got labeled with this name, and then the reactionaries went to the other extreme.
The reactionaries at the Finn camp claimed, you know, but there was
no that's what I'm trying to understand.
See, there was no such thing as a label. Only their utterances that created those labels, you know. In other words, they were the McCarthy.